I'm going to try and outline the general process of individual and cultural development that Whitmont's talking about, which I think is still a little on the obscure side to everybody. And I'm going to lead up to what I consider to be a very important passage in his chapter on mental development. So the idea is I'm going to explain that paragraph in that chapter before I read it to you. Then after I read it to you, I'll go back to what we were talking about, and hopefully this is going to help you understand the developmental process that Whitmont's outlining, which is what's so important. And if it doesn't work, we'll talk about it until you get it, either today, tomorrow, or the next day, or whatever. So here's the basic idea, and it's on this little chart that I've actually drawn on the whiteboard. So the person is the circle, and the world is the square, not chosen arbitrarily, of course, given what we know about symbolic thought. But the main thing is that you can understand the person as having conscious and unconscious aspects. This is what comes out of psychoanalytic thought, the analytic psychology of Jung and all his successors. This is the splitting that Whitmont refers to over and over again. And the way people split changes over time. So what's in the unconscious for a person that lived 10,000 years ago and what's in the unconscious of those of us in this room now is not going to be the same. All right, so for one thing, that's a basic principle, that what gets split off from the conscious mind changes over time. And it changes over time because the world, the environment that you're in, is different over time, right? So if the big thing that primitive people don't feel comfortable with is what we would consider rational thought, like causation, that's going to be in their unconscious mind, both individually and collectively, and this is the main point. Because the collective is only made up of a group of individuals. That's all a collective is a group of individuals. But that group of individuals does have sort of like collective information that's out there. It's okay, don't worry about it. So in the modern situation, because we don't really know what was going on for primitives, in the modern situation, the individual mind, you know, might have varying unconscious contents, but on the whole, most of us have similar unconscious contents. And that stuff is projected outside of ourselves, but generally we think of it as objectively real. Okay? So for example, it is a collective belief that the world is made up of tangible matter. Here's a good one for you. We all believe the world is made up of tangible matter. Anybody would disagree with that? We're not going to get any disagreement in that class. What is it? Now, if I ask you what it is, and you start describing it to me, the way in which you're going to describe it is based upon your own mentality. And some of what's in your mentality you're aware of, and some of what's in your mentality you're not aware of. Okay. Now, how extreme can this be? I'll share a story with you. And this, I'm not making this story up. This came from a colleague of mine who's a professor of religious studies at Columbia University. He's in a building which for some reason also includes the theoretical physicists. God only knows why they put the religious studies department and the physics department in the same building. He said the guy in the office below him, I don't know how many floors below him, who he knew, would come into his office and he'd sit there and he'd begin thinking about problems in theoretical physics, which is to say he was thinking mathematically. And in order for him to be able to do this, what he would do in order to cope with what was going on in his mind, I guess he might say, is he put on snowshoes. Why would he put on snowshoes? I am not making this up. Why would he put on snowshoes to sit in his office and think about theoretical physics? Because when he thought about physics, he thought about matter. And when he thought about matter, he recognized that there was less stuff here than there was empty space. And his emotional side would get nervous about falling through the empty space. because there's mostly empty space under his feet. So he put on snowshoes. Now, of course, snowshoes. Well, you can wear flip-flops and snowshoes, can't you? So now, obviously, snowshoes are not going to keep anybody from falling through the empty space in the floor of the physics offices at Columbia University. It was not a rational matter. There was some other part of him that was satisfied by this operation. And he knew it, and everybody else knew it, and it was just like, okay, he's one of those professors, right? That's okay. Brilliant mind. But his emotional side is a little, right? Okay, so you get the idea I'm talking about. So what's in the unconscious, if we go back to our chart, is projected outside. And the way in which our mind understands the world is based not just upon what's in the rational conscious mind, for us rational conscious mind, but what is also in the unconscious mind, and we're not aware of what's in the unconscious mind. Contains a lot of archaic stuff from earlier levels of development. Mythic material, magical material, or mythopoetic material is one of the ways in which this is discussed. Okay, that influences how we experience the outer world. Our collective agreements about the nature of the outer world thus are in many ways dependent upon the aggregated unconsciousnesses of all the people who hold those collective agreements. Jung called this the collective unconscious. There's a reason I don't want to use that language right now. Okay, so it's the sum total of all the individual unconsciousnesses of the planet have collectively agreed upon what is the nature of external reality. It's not a given, right? And in fact, there are variations in that. For sure, when the biologists who teach at EOU go out into the country, what they see is not what I see when I go out in the country. They see refinements of biological processes that I absolutely cannot see. Now, I'm unconscious of those things, not because I've repressed them or split off from them. It's just my conscious mind isn't trained to see those sorts of things, right? All these processes are at work, but generally we agree upon the nature of external reality. But those agreements include projections of unconscious material. Okay. Now, there's a dynamic that goes on here, though. It's not just fixed, right? Because the external projections change over time as the unconscious material changes over time. So as collective humanity is developing or evolving, depending upon whichever word you like, what gets projected outside as the nature of the world changes. Okay. So what primal peoples projected because of the world they lived in and their agreements about what's real is different than what we project. And it changes over time because their world changed over time and their projections change over time. Right? So now this gets us into religious phenomena. Because primal people projected gods into the world, right? So there were unconscious forces going on in them, instincts, to use Whitmont's language, that they projected into the world. You know, it's like, I want to beat you up because whatever, I don't know. You know, this is an aggressive fantasy. Because there's only so much mammoth meat to go around, right? And we can't share it. I want it. The only way I'm going to be sure to get it is to beat you up. This is pretty simplistic, okay? The tendency toward aggression in that case is projected outward, at not as an impulse, which we would be, that would be our language, but as a deity. You know, it's like the devil made me do it. You know, we have that kind of language. It's like there's an external force that made me do this thing. It's not my responsibility because, of course, primitive people don't even know they have an unconscious. They've never thought about this. That's a rational idea, that you have an unconscious. Even in the mythic realm, people don't know they have an unconscious. They just are what they are. This is a rational idea. Okay. Similarly, in regards to the Great Mother, for example, as another image, it's kind of like primal peoples understand themselves emerging from this matrix of existence and returning to it. That's what birth, life, and death is, right? They understood it as maternal, And why do they understand it as maternal? Because if you actually look at the physical level of what happens to a human being, it emerges from the mother. All animals emerge from their mother. All plants emerge from the earth, right? And primal peoples looked at the body and they didn't see it as being different from the earth in the way in which we see it as being different from the earth, right? So the idea that giving birth to a child that we have is a child pops out of the mother's body. Well, it doesn't pop, of course. But a child comes out of the mother's body, you know. We see the mother's body as separate from the world. So we see the child coming out of the mother but not coming out of the world. If you don't see mother and world as separate, then the child is coming out of the world, not just coming out of the mother, because there's not a distinction between the two in the way in which we make a distinction, right? So, wow, what's the creation of life? The great mother. And so that's projected as this goddess. So this is where this idea, by sort of a simplistic analysis, of the great goddess comes from. But as time goes on, environment changes, people take up agriculture, for example, instead of living in caves and chasing mammoths or whatever they're doing. Because the outer world has changed, their relationship with it changes, so the inner world changes, and what's in the unconscious and what gets projected out into the world begins to shift over time. And there's a dynamic, because what's in the world changes what's in our experience, which therefore changes what's in the unconscious, which therefore changes what's getting projected outward over time. It's not just one way. I drew it this way, as if it were one way, but really, it's also like this, that what's out here goes back in and changes, right? So this dynamic of outside and inside as the environment changes is really what Whitman is talking about when he's talking about the development both of individual and collective consciousness. So what gets projected outward as the gods, as images, as understanding what's going on in the world, both what's projected outward from the unconscious and what's perceived from the conscious mind, right? As these things change over time, the images change over time, the idea of the powers change over time, because what's in the unconscious and the conscious changes over time. And the relationship between the conscious and the unconscious changes over time. So for example, if you happen to be living in a tribal world and somebody comes down off of a mountain with some tablets, and the tablets say, here are the 10 things you absolutely can't do, and by the way, if you do them, we're going to kill you. Collectively, as a tribe, we're going to kill you if you do any of these things, so we're going to enforce these ideas, right? You can't do these things. So what happens to people who have the impulse to do those sorts of things? They have to figure out how to control them, right? If the commandments say, don't covet your neighbor's wife, and you don't happen to be King David, although the story of what happens to King David for coveting somebody else's wife is illustrative of something, right? If you covet your neighbor's wife, okay, or your neighbor's husband, doesn't really make any difference as far as the commandments are concerned, right? You have this desire for someone. It's wrong, you know it's wrong, but even that's not so much the point. The point is if you do anything, it's dangerous, okay? So the view of the analyst, the psychoanalyst, is the way you deal with this is by ignoring it. And if you're a child and you have these kinds of impulses, the way you deal with it is by splitting off. And you develop the habit of splitting off. It's like, I'm not coveting my neighbor's husband or wife. That's something else that's going on here. Right? It ain't me, because it's in the unconscious, so it's projected outward. It's not me, it's out there. Something's going on out there. It's those bad Philistines. They're the ones who are responsible for what I'm feeling. That's really the way the process works. So how do you deal with those bad Philistines that put you in danger because of the way you're feeling? You go kill them. Because then you've solved the problem of feeling something you don't want to feel. But of course, that doesn't solve the problem, right? Because as soon as the Philistines are dead, right, then there's somebody else that's a problem. And there has to be somebody else that's a problem, right? So you look at biblical history and you see this kind of thing going on over and over and over again. But there's still this dynamic going on as things are changing, because the environment is changing. Now that you've gotten rid of the Philistines, you've got a different group. Maybe they're the Assyrians. Well, the Assyrians have a whole different mentality than the Philistines, right? So you have a different group of people who presents a different kind of problem to you, even though you're projecting the same concerns onto them. So again, there's this dynamic that's developing. So when Whitman talks about the goddess and then the development of the twin gods, say Dionysus and Apollo, or this kind of thing, the process that he's talking about is what's going on here in the unconscious mind, where originally you have the goddess and her consorts, who in the most archaic sense, the most archaic world, are animals. The consorts of the goddess in the archaic world tend to be animals. Serpent, bull, certain kinds of birds, this kind of thing. So what happens as the dynamic relationship between conscious and unconscious changes, and what's allowed into consciousness and what's forced into unconsciousness changes, these elements of the male and female that are in the unconscious also change, and therefore the projections into the world change, okay? So where the Babylonians might see the great goddess accompanied by, say, a serpent, right? Because a serpent travels on the earth. The goddess is the earth, right? Serpent travels on the earth, lives in holes in the earth, something like that, comes out of the earth. Now then, if the Babylonians, didn't I say Babylonians? Right, okay. So now if the Babylonians are the bad guys under which you're projecting all of your negative stuff, right, then everything that's associated with their deities is also bad. So the goddess is bad, the serpents are bad, and anything else associated with the goddess is bad. So now that stuff gets, first off, pushed down into your subconscious. But second off, what happens if the Babylonians and you go to war and you lose? Okay. Now you have a new set of problems to deal with, because their goddess beat your god, and how are you going to deal with that? Right. What does that say about your god, and what was your god doing, and so on and so forth. So here the dynamics get really complicated. And if you start reading biblical history, you see this. Right? What happens when Israel, Judea, because it was two states, are conquered by the Assyrians, by the Persian Empire, okay, and are taken into captivity. Sorry, not the Persian Empire. Conquered by the Babylonians, and they're taken into captivity. Well, their god lost. How can their god lose? Okay, something else must have been going on. So now the prophets arise and they say, hey, what was going on was you guys weren't good, right? What does that mean? Your oppressions were all what? Okay, your projections were all what? There's a problem here. So now the prophets are talking about this. And then what happens when the Babylonians in turn get their behinds beaten by the Persian Empire, and then the Persian Empire releases the Jews here in captivity and says, you can go back to Judea, some of them. It's like, oh, well, our God is still okay. So what did that mean? Is their God okay too? What does all this stuff mean? And so they got to work all this thing out. So in the process of working this out, with this kind of dynamic, what gets projected over and over and over again changes, right? Okay. So historically, one of the things that Whitman says is that the goddess has these consorts, and the projections of the nature of the consorts is changing over time. Not just the image of who they are, but the relationship between them is changing over time. Okay, so if the goddess has a consort, like a bull, who's viewed as related to the earth, and this is positive, then fine. You know, the projections are all good. But if you are in conflict with that society, either for developmental reasons or economic reasons, right, now what they have as their god and goddess is not a good thing anymore, because they're the bad guys, right? So what happens? So now you have to take that and turn it into something that's bad. But what happens when you turn the goddess and the goddess's consort into something bad? Now it's projected in, now it's stuck in your unconscious, and it gets projected in certain negative ways. And then you have to deal with those negative projections, right? That's what the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur is about. This process, where you start out with the bull as being positive in the Cretan environment, but negative to the Greeks, right? So then they take the original story of Ariadne and the bull, which probably was positive, or the Minotaur, which was probably positive, and they make it negative. Oh, the Greek youth have to be sacrificed to the Minotaur in the labyrinth, right? And now that's viewed as negative. The labyrinth is viewed as negative. But then what do you get? You get not only is the Minotaur negative, but now you got Theseus who kills the Minotaur, saves the Athenian youth. That makes him a hero, right? So now we get into this issue with the hero myth, which we're going to be dealing with when we talk about Campbell, which is something new that arises in a later age. And the hero does what? The hero is the one that defeats the negative projections. What are the negative projections? The Minotaur, the bull, the snake, this, that, and the other thing, right? So now the dynamic continues and continues to continue. And the projections and the splits become deeper and deeper and transform over time. So the snake is not only not a good thing who's in relationship with the goddess, the snake is now a bad thing. And the snake is such a bad thing that now it's opposed to all the good things. So the snake turns into the devil, who is opposed to Christ or God or whoever you want to see it as opposed to, depending upon your theology. So the divisions are getting greater, the splits are getting greater, the projections are also getting more and more confused as the process goes on, because the dynamic process is causing them to be layered. So at a certain point, people look at the snake and they only see something negative. They're not actually even capable of seeing its earlier history where it was positive. And then what happens? We get into the modern age and you have science, archaeology, excavations, art history, biblical scholarship and interpretation, and then what happens? Now you have people looking through the deeper and deeper and deeper layers of things, and they're bringing their mental capacity into understanding the deeper collective layers of all of this projection, and they begin disentangling it. And then we begin disentangling it, what's happening. What's happening now is that the layers are connecting with each other. So the mental layer is now connecting with the mythopoeic or mythic level and the magical level in ways that it couldn't connect in the past. And then unusual stuff starts happening. Because now, one of the things we know from Jungian thought is people attempt to make themselves whole. They attempt to resolve the conscious and unconscious splits because those are uncomfortable, right? They attempt to make themselves whole, and the vision of the whole, which is the self, from Jung's point of view, is also the God image, because God is the complete thing, okay? So I'll set that aside for a moment and come back to it. But they attempt to make themselves whole, and unusual things happen in the attempt to make yourself whole. Because if you're performing this intellectual archaeology, you have certain information, but you also have your unconscious projections. They don't go away. So what happens in this process of attempting to make yourself whole? We ended yesterday's session by looking at this ballet, which was first staged in 1913. Now, the origin of the Rite of Spring is a dream that Stravinsky had. He dreamed the basic theme of the music, okay? From that, he took it to Diaghilev, I think that's pronunciation his name, who was the impresario of the Ballet Russe, which was this very advanced Russian ballet that was doing well in Paris, which was a center of all culture at the time, right? He takes it to him and he says, we can make a ballet out of this music, right? Well, the great dancer of the time, Nijinsky, who happens to be the lover of the impresario, is given the task of choreographing the ballet. Turns out Nijinsky's schizophrenic, which is interesting. Okay. They also employ Nicholas Rorick, who is an archaeologist, to design the sets and the costumes. What Rorick does is he actually looks at what they've been discovering in Eastern Europe as they're excavating tombs. What did people look like? How did they dress? What were their religious ceremonies? The music is understood to be because of the dream that Stravinsky has. The music is an expression of what the archaeologists like Rorick are discovering. Nijinsky, though, when he choreographs it, so here's the, now it's going to be this ballet that's meaning to express this earlier stratum of awareness. So who's the archaeologist? Rorick, who's completing himself. Who's the musician? Stravinsky, who is completing himself, because this is emerging through a dream, right? Rorick gives the vision of things, which seems to be somewhat authentic, but Nijinsky creates these very strange movements, which freak everybody out. The ballet dancers don't even know how to do this stuff. And when the audience sees it, on the one hand, they are really emotionally driven by this music, which they've never heard anything like before. Okay. And then they see these really weird movements that are created by this genius dancer who just happens to be schizophrenic, i.e. broken. And there are all these strange, jerky movements. Everyone, not everyone, most people totally freak out when they see this. Why? Because what's happened is the three of them together have tapped into the subconscious mind of the Parisians with this archaic experience. Think of what happens at the end of the ballet. At the very end of the ballet, the central dancer, who is chosen to be the sacrificial dancer, and if you look at the ballet closely in the way in which she's chosen, she falls out. That's how she's chosen. It's not like somebody picks her. There's a natural process in which she's being picked. She, quote, dances herself to death, okay, through all these dramatic, jerky movements at the end. I mean, you think, if you actually look at what she's doing, you think she'd pass out from exhaustion, right? She falls to the ground, she lifts herself up for a moment, and then collapses, and then the rest of the dancers come around, they pick her up, and they hold her up. This is the sacrificial offering to the god, goddess of spring, to renew life, okay? These are all Christians who created this. They understood what the Mass was when you lift the cup up and the Holy Spirit descends into the cup and transforms the wine into the blood of Christ. It's a magical operation, and it happens in spring. It's a renewal of life. That's what death and resurrection and Easter's all about. Hold on. It's a renewal of life, right? So they're showing on a primitive level, their idea of a primitive level, the same process, but it's their idea of a primitive level. Ancient Slavic people, who knows how they danced, but they probably didn't dance like that because they weren't broken in that way. They weren't schizophrenic like Nijinsky, but they also weren't geniuses like Nijinsky. Okay. No wonder there was a near riot in Paris when they saw and heard this stuff. I mean, think about what it rattled around inside of a lot of people. Okay, because the Mass has now been transformed into the earlier pagan ceremony which preceded the Mass, of which the death and resurrection of Christ as one of the dying and reborn gods is a symbol. Because again, over and over again, as time goes on, the patterns repeat themselves in new forms with new projections. So there were many dying and resurrected gods in the ancient Mediterranean world. Jesus happened to be one of them. What was unique about Jesus being sacrificed and resurrected was with his sacrifice and resurrection, it's never going to happen again. It's not an annual cycle, exactly. Except we have to remember it as an annual cycle because we have spring every year. You can't get rid of the earlier levels of experience, even if you have a later understanding of things based upon a later evolutionary process. So let me take your question for us, and then I want to read you something where Whitmont really describes the process. This is what everything in Whitmont is leading up to. Yeah, so what was your question?
My question was about the play. Like, there was no speaking
into
no.
the play, right? It was completely just...
It's not a play.
It was ballet, yeah, sure. But it was like, it wanted to transfer their ideas through emotion and...
Music and movement.
Music, like,
and design, set design and costume. Okay. Choreography, yeah. Right.
Like...
Nobody speaks anything.
Probably would have been worse if someone would have had spoken.
There, if you want to get a sense of... Yeah, if you want to get a sense of what might have happened at the time, okay, BBC produced something around the Joffrey Ballet's recreation, 1987 recreation of the ballet called Riot at the Right.
Riot at the Right?
Riot at the Right. You can watch it for free on YouTube.
As in R-I-T-E?
R-I-T-E. Riot at the Right, as in Rite of Spring. You can watch it for free at YouTube, and it's really interesting. It'll give you a feel for what happened. This is what happens when a new turn of collective consciousness comes into the world. So now let me read this passage. This is a long passage, but let me read this passage in Whitmont. Okay. So this passage is on page 73, and I'll read it because this is what I've been building up to and what I've been trying to express here. Toward the bottom of the page. But while the focus of consciousness has shifted to the new mental quality, because we're now talking about the three stages of evolution or development, the older dynamics do not cease to operate. They are merely split off or repressed from our new awareness. Now he's going to go into really talking about the collective developmental process. Independently of our rational consciousness, the repressed split-off psychic organism continues to function in the form of what we now call the magical and mythological dimensions of the unconscious. Remember, this is collective and individual. Our unconscious fantasies, imaginings, emotions, drive, instinctual awarenesses, ESP capacities, and participation mystique, comes out of anthropology, are all parts of this. Unbeknownst to us, these unconscious strata modify and complement, but also thwart, our reasoning. Our scientific worldview, the moral standards held by collective consciousness, and our personal goals based on those values come from rationalizations and codifications of the preceding period, because they've been projected. Yesterday's myth, poetical aspiration, fable, or fantasy becomes rationalized into today's space-visible historical fact. God is said to have literally given the Decalogue to Israel. Jesus' sacrificial death and resurrection are believed as historical facts, not as myth. That's his view. Okay. Meanwhile, unconscious psychic activity never stops. All established value standards eventually evoke extensions and amplifications as well as complementary or antithetical counterpositions in the unconscious psyche. Okay, so now we're looking at things changing over time and mutually influencing each other. These are again modified, extended, or opposed once they become entrenched in collective standards. New motifs and variants then arise with a still later cycle. These back and forth rhythms and their larger spacings occur also in smaller cycles, down to the 10 and 20 year cycles that make for the proverbial generation gaps. That is, whatever your parents detest is what you're going to like. Whatever they don't want you to be, that's what you're going to be. Whatever they couldn't cope with, you're going to explore. That's on the positive side of it. Thus, one mythopoeic wave follows the other. Little waves within larger ones, within centuries, within millennial spanning epochs. The Renaissance, Enlightenment, Industrial Age are all sub-cycles of the epic of the rational mind. Each has its own sub-mythology, its variations of the Judeo-Christian myth, varying and counterpointing the preceding rhythms of outward and inward turning. Here he gives an example. Within the larger outward-directed mental cycle, the Renaissance and Industrial Revolution turned even further outward. Medieval mysticism in the Romantic era looked inward. Medieval mysticism, industrialism, romanticism, out in, out in, out in. Hence the precipitate of yesterday's myth in the collective consciousness, which is to say what's been externalized and we're aware of and agreed upon, is at variance with its contemporary unconscious mythopoetic activity, and that's the important thing. So what's out there that we agree upon is in conflict with what we're collectively unconscious of. There's a conflict between the two. Because what's out there is what used to be in there. It got projected out. We got okay with it, and that means there's new unconscious stuff that we're not okay with. Likewise, in the psychology of the individual, dreams extend, complement, amplify, and compensate the dreamer's current conscious position. Today's mythical fantasy, unconscious, and rationalized by the mental attitude, points towards tomorrow's development of consciousness. So what's in our collective unconscious now will be in our collective conscious in the future. What collectively we're not conscious of now, collectively we will be conscious of in the future. This gets us to the return of the goddess. Hence, today's publicly professed standards and beliefs reflect what has been accomplished and codified as the result of past mythologizing. Much of the conventional accepted wisdom and morality may be marked for change in the future. Indeed, it may already be at variance with the actual facts and beliefs of contemporary life. The publicly accepted belief in order, obedience to law, the Christian ethic of love are turned, twisted, flaunted, and disregarded whenever it suits our purpose. In turn, the experiential fulfillment of the authentic Christian myth and ethic may still be waiting to be accomplished in the period ahead of us. Right? So, do you get what he's saying here? What's in our collective unconscious now in the way of ideas about the fundamentals of religion, are, because they're in our unconscious, we're not aware of, but they reflect some developmental process. What we're aware of was in the unconscious of earlier stages. Right? So what we take to be the truth about religious life was created by the projections from the collective unconscious of former peoples. And this dynamic has been going on for millennia. So now, what happens when new things are emerging in the collective unconscious? Right? They're at variance with what's in the external consciousness. So think about feminism in the modern world, or think about spiritual feminism in the water world. Where did it come from? Was it a political decision that was made in Washington, D.C., that somehow women were going to be able to have equal opportunities for jobs, for pay, to vote? Heck no! That's not where it came from. Right? It came from someplace else. And where it came from was definitely at variance with a collective, agreed-upon, conscious standards of the time. So now there's an incredible conflict between the collective consciousness and the collective unconsciousness. And if you read about the history of suffragism or the women's movement, you see this process at work. You see it at work in racial relationships. You see it at work in the relationship between ethnicities. You see it at work in Germany in the 30s. You see it at work over and over and over again. And the main point, because this is a class in what is religion and in the study of religion, the main point is that the great theological systems and values which are collectively agreed upon are based upon former unconscious visions of things that got projected outward, got systematized, got understood, got accepted, and in that process are now in conflict with new unconscious values, right? So what kind of things do you have? You have religions where only men can be priests, but that's in conflict with something that's going on in the collective unconscious mind, which is releasing the value of female values and female consciousness, right? So now you have big problems that are going. If you look at what's happening in the Episcopal Church, for example, you know, you see movements in some places where women are being created as priests, and then other bishops in the church are saying, that's no good. We're going to have to outlaw that, you know. And so people get excommunicated for this stuff. We don't burn them at the stake anymore, but we take away their parish and we throw them out of the church. So I could go on this way, but let me stop and